you know, anyway, I want to start because we had really a great speaker tonight. I'm really delighted to introduce our speaker tonight, Dr. Stefan Lekowa, who is a professor or assistant professor of political science at Sciences Po. His basic research interests are the dialectical relations between Islam and politics in the contemporary Middle East. I know if you really have the time to read one book on Saudi Arabia, you must read his book, Awakening Islam, The Politics of Religious Dissent. And I think it was published by Harvard. When was it published?
Last year.
Truly one of the best books on Saudi Arabia. And I say it as a neutral observer, I hope. What I really like about, I know I sound about what he does, and he's part of a contingent, young contingent, French scholars who really combine the best, what we call extensive field research with any methodologies, social sciences methodology. Stefan spent a great deal of time in Saudi Arabia doing field research for his book, and as you know, it's not easy to do field research in Saudi Arabia. Many of us cannot even get a visa, let alone spend. So there is something, he has something very exceptional by spending some time in Saudi Arabia. And now he's doing some field research in Egypt. And this is really, this contingent of young French scholars is really producing some of the most original work, I would say, on social movements, and in particular on the movements, what we call political Islam, broadly defined. By the way, my name is Fawaz Jerges, and I teach the modern Middle East here at the London School of Economics, and I welcome you to another event at the Middle Eastern Center. Our Middle Eastern Center is hosting today's event. Some of you who do not know about the Salafists, I don't blame you, I mean, it's a very complex movement. I mean, the word Salafi in Arabic is a Salaf, which means ancestor. And I think I would not be exaggerating if I say that the Salafis have a fascination for the past, for the Golden Age, particularly the Golden Age of Islam. And again, the Salafis are not basically new agents. They have always been part of the social and the religious landscape in the Muslim world. And they have recently burst out into the political scene. So this is because the Salafis used to be very part of the quietest school or family or element within the Islamist family. Now they are extremely active, if I might use the term, very hyper, a potent segment, a small potent segment within the Islamist family, and I will argue a wild card in Arab and Muslim politics. The first question I think many of us would like to understand, who are the Salafis? What are the worldviews? Remember, it's not just one worldview, because there are multiple aspects of Salafism. What are the drivers that help us understand the rise of the Salafis, in particular, into the political space after the Arab uprisings? His talk is entitled Sheikhs, Politicians, and Revolutionaries. The political sociology Islamist in the aftermath of the Arab uprisings. So there is something about the Arab uprising that has really helped the Salafists to burst into the political scene. So what are the worldviews of the Salafists? What's the sociological genealogy of Salafism or Salafisms? What are the differences between Salafis and the mainstream Islamists? And what are the common bonds between the Salafis and mainstream Islamists? I really would not be exaggerating. Few scholars are as skilled and as knowledgeable about the political sociology of Salafism as Stefan. So please join me in welcoming our speaker to the LSE.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Professor Jedis. It's a great pleasure and honor to be here at the LSE. And thank you to the Middle East Center, of course, for organizing this talk. My talk here will be about Salafism and politics in the post-Arab Spring context. I will be focusing on Egypt because I believe that this country offers an ideal, typical case study of the challenges faced by Salafis when they find themselves in an open political context. What also makes Egypt particularly interesting is that the Salafi movement there was present before the revolution in already very large numbers, and that the majority of Salafis have decided to enter the formal political field in the wake of Mubarak's fall, eventually becoming the country's second political force. The last reason why I've chosen to focus on Egypt in this talk is that I've been doing fieldwork in Egypt since October 2010, which gave me the opportunity to observe and study Egyptian Salafis before, during, and after the revolution. I will, however, throughout my presentation, make references to Salafis in other Arab countries in order to show how the situation in Egypt may be similar to the situation elsewhere. As we shall see, and this will be the core of my argument, this encounter with politics caused significant tensions within Egyptian Salafism, leading to the rise of three distinct factions among Egyptian Salafis, each of which has a distinct understanding of the aims and legitimate means of politics. First is what I call pre-political Salafism. Pre-political Salafis refuse the logic of politics for the sake of politics, and they only advocate having representatives in the political sphere to defend the interests of the religious movement, and they consider the religious logic to be the only logic that should be followed. Second is what I call political Salafism, as distinguished from pre-political Salafism. Political Salafis fully embrace the political logic, and they are ready to a large extent to distinguish it from the religious theological logic. They tend to become pragmatic, and they would like the political Salafi movement to be, and I'm quoting one of them here, a political movement like all others. The third faction is what I called populist revolutionary Salafism. Populist revolutionary Salafis advocate the immediate implementation of Sharia as a solution to all problems, but they reject institutional means and they prefer radical revolutionary change. Jihadis can be considered populist revolutionary Salafis, but I think the phenomenon of populist revolutionary Salafism is broader than jihadism. And this is because populist revolutionary Salafis do not necessarily have the internationalist culture of the jihadis, and they do not necessarily subscribe to the ideological tenets of the jihadis. Again, so I'm going to discuss these categories with you. I'm not entirely happy with the terms, by the way, especially the pre-political terms. So I'll be happy in the discussion, actually, if you have suggestions on how I should call them. I could have called them Salafism X, Y, and Z, but I thought it was more interesting to try to give them names. But again, naming things is always very difficult. So let's start with distinguishing these three phenomena, and I will explain in detail what I mean. And I believe these categories not merely apply to Egyptian Salafism, but they can also be applied elsewhere. But before I introduce those categories in the Egyptian context, I will start with a bit of history, which will be useful to clarify the concepts I will be using. Although it only started making the headlines in the wake of the revolution, the existence of the Salafi movement is nothing new in Egypt. The first association claiming to be Salafi was called Ansar al-Sunnah al-Muhammadiyya, the proponents of Muhammadan tradition, and it was created in 1926, 2 years before the Muslim Brotherhood. And I must say, Salafis are generally quite proud to stress that point in response to the accusations that they are an important movement, actually, whether 2 years before the Muslim Brotherhood. Although, of course, this argument should be qualified because most of Ansar al-Sunnah's references were taken from Saudi Arabia and from Saudi Salafism. So all of the two organizations, Ansar al-Sunnah Muhammadiyya on the one hand and the Muslim Brotherhood on the other hand, championed the idea of a revival of Islam. They did so in very different ways. For the Muslim Brotherhood, the revival was essentially expressed in political terms. The project of the Brothers was to create what they call an Islamic State, Dawla Islamiyya. For Ansar al-Sunnah Salafis, in contrast, what was needed was a religious revival, implying, on the one hand, the purification of the Muslim creed, al-Aqidah, in order to put it in line with what they deem to be original or Salafi Islam, and implying, on the other hand, a reform of individual social and religious practices against Sufism or Shiism in particular. Ansar Sunnah, however, stopped short of developing any political vision. Another difference with the Brotherhood was that, far from being a mass movement, Ansar Sunnah merely constituted a network of religious scholars whose main activity was to edit and publish books from the Salafi tradition. In the 1970s, Egypt experienced what can be referred to as the second wave of Salafism. Those were the years of Anwar Sadat's presidency, and Sadat had allowed Islamic movements to operate relatively freely in the country. At the forefront of those movements were the university groups called the Jamaat Islamiyya, whose ideology reflected a wide range of influences. They borrowed from the Muslim Brotherhood, they read the books of Sayyid Qutb, but they were also influenced by the Salafi literature made available through Ansar Sunnah networks. The regional influence of Saudi Arabia, which now possessed the money to export its brand of Islam through a range of government-funded institutions, added to the spread of Salafism. The plurality of influences that was present in the Jamaat Islamiyya's ideological fabric soon sparked lively debates among the group's members. This led to a split around 1977-1978. The majority of Jamaat Islamiyya members joined the Muslim Brotherhood, where they were instrumental in reviving the organization, which had been greatly weakened under Nasser. And this is when Jamaat Islamiyya members Issam al-A'yan or Abdul Munim Abu al-Futuh, among others, joined the Muslim Brotherhood. And those, I mean, Issam al-A'yan is one of the highest members in the Muslim Brotherhood today, and Abu al-Futuh was before he left in 2009. Others from the Jamaat Islamiyya disagreed, and they advocated a radical and violent approach, understood in the terms of Sayyid Qutb. They founded a group called Al-Jamaa al-Islamiyya in the singular form, later co-responsible for Sadat's assassination in 1981. Finally, a third group decided to distance itself from the ideas of the Muslim Brotherhood altogether and adopt a pure Salafi approach. The leading figures of that group were members of the were students at the Faculty of Medicine of Alexandria University. Among them was Muhammad Ismail al-Muqaddim, Ahmed Farid, and Yasser Borhami, who's now one of the highest members in the movement, and the most high-profile ones. They decided to establish an organization that they first called Al-Madrasa Salafiyya, the Salafi school. It was later renamed Dawa Salafiyya, the Salafi call, or the Salafi Dawa. Just like Ansar al-Sunnah, the Salafi Dawa proclaimed that its aim was to purify the Muslim creed along Salafi lines, and to, quote-unquote, correct what was wrong in the social and religious practices of Egyptian Muslims. Their action was therefore limited to preaching, and it has no explicit political dimension. And for the next three decades, they would make sure to avoid the political issue altogether. The difference with Ansar al-Sunnah, however, was that the Salafi Dawah's founders, despite being apolitical, had been socialized in the context of 1970s Islamic activism. And they were what we can call Harakiyin activists. What they wanted the Salafi Dawah to be was a mass movement with a cohesive and well-organized structure, a long line somewhat similar to the Muslim Brotherhood. One of the founders of the organization, his name is Abu Idris, he was named Al-Qayyim, the Salafi Dawah's equivalent of the Muslim Brotherhood's Murshid, the guide. And the Salafi Dawah started sponsoring a range of social activities in the poor neighborhoods of Alexandria at the beginning and then in other Egyptian cities, although this activism remained more informal than in the case of the Muslim Brotherhood. In the wake of Sadat's assassination in 1981, the Salafi Dawah, unlike most other Islamic groups, escaped persecution because of its non-political stance. In the subsequent years, the Salafi Dawah did even sometimes benefit from the covert support of Amn al-Dawla, the Egyptian security apparatus, because the security apparatus saw the Salafis as a useful counterforce to the more politicized Islamic groups, especially the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Jamaa al-Islamiyya. To be sure, the Salafis were also closely monitored and sometimes repressed by the authorities, but they were generally in a much more favorable position than their competitors. In this context, the Salafi Dawah was able to expand beyond its base in Alexandria to other Egyptian governments. In the 2000s, the government decided to step up its anti-Brotherhood strategy by allowing Salafis to open satellite TV channels Many of them were broadcasted through Mansat, so they were accessible to all Egyptian viewers. Within a few years, a fair amount of Salafi channels were created. Qanat al-Nas, Qanat al-Rahma, etc. Soon they became extremely popular with Egyptian viewers, turning certain preachers, such as Mohammed Hassan, Mohammed Hussein Yaqub, into nationwide stars. This allowed Salafism to gain hundreds of thousands of sympathizers and to extend its influence far beyond the organized networks of the Salafi Dawah. When the revolution started on the 25th of January 2011, most Salafi sheikhs called for their followers not to join the protests. For a group which advocated individual religious reform and did not believe that political activism was desirable at all, this would hardly be surprising. But on the 8th of February 2011, a few days before the fall of Mubarak, the Salafi leaders revised their position. The protests were no longer described as fitna, chaos, division. They were now described as thawra, revolution. Most observers at the time saw this as mere opportunism. This would, however, retrospectively mark the beginning of a deep evolution inside Egyptian Salafism. In the wake of, the revolution, a few figures in the Salafi Dawah argued that because the context had now changed, the Dawah's position towards politics should change as well. For them, this meant that just like the Muslim Brotherhood, which was about to create its party, the Freedom and Justice Party, Al-Hurriya wal-Adala, the Dawah should establish its own party as well. The rationale was that now that the political sphere was open, the Salafis needed a political representation to defend their interests and expand their influence. Spearheading those calls was a man whose profile was relatively peculiar within the Salafi Dawah. This man is Imad al-Ghafur, who's a doctor, who had spent the last 10 years before the revolution working in Turkey. As Abdul-Ghafur explains in an interview, it was the Turkish experience of Islamic politics that changed his mind, and he was waiting for the opportunity to, and I'm quoting, make the Salafi Dawah benefit from this experience. At the same time, Abdul-Ghafur carried a lot of weight within the Salafi Dawah. He had been one of the founders of the organization in the late 1970s. And although he had moved away from it a little bit in the last decade, he continued to enjoy great respect within it. After numerous debates, Abdul-Ghafur managed to convince the Dawah's leadership to support his project. The creation of Hizb an-Nur, the Party of Light, was announced, and Abdul-Ghafur was appointed as the president of the party. Officially, Hizb an-Nur was to be the political arm of the Salafi Dawah, and the Dawah's help was instrumental in setting up the party. Within a couple of weeks, the party already claimed 100,000 members across Egypt. I insist here on the agency of Imad al-Ghafur because I don't think that what happened was a structural evolution at all. Had it not been for al-Ghafur's activism and his aura in the movement, the Salafi Dawah would have decided to remain out of politics. And if we compare with Tunisia, we see that this is what happened in Tunisia, where most Salafis have refused to enter the formal political sphere, despite recent attempts at creating three political parties in Tunisia, but they haven't demonstrated any real influence for the moment. So most Tunisian Salafis have remained out of politics. So again, Abdul-Ghafur was instrumental in this change. I should add that a few of the small Salafi parties were created in Egypt at the same time, in addition to Hizb an-Nur. But most had very local followings, and none had the infrastructural power of Hizb an-Nur. And so Hizb an-Nur quickly imposed itself as the dominant Salafi party by far. One of the early goals of Hizb an-Nur was to assert its existence as a political entity independent in its agenda from the Muslim Brotherhood. And this was needed because many Egyptians, and the Muslim Brotherhood themselves actually, saw the Salafis as nothing more than a reservoir of support for the Brotherhood. This explains why Hizb an-Nur chose to compete against the Muslim Brotherhood in the legislative elections that took place from November 2011 to January 2012. And so, while the Brotherhood established what they called a democratic coalition, Tahalluf al-Demokrati, in which they brought small, secular, and centrist parties, the Salafis created another coalition called the Islamic Coalition, Tahalluf al-Islami, in which they brought two smaller Salafi-leaning parties. One is Hizb al-Asala, which was created by the students of a Cairo-based sheikh called Muhammad Abdul Maqsoud. But this is a party with a very local following in certain districts of Cairo. And another party called Al-Bina al-Tanmiya, who is the political arm of the Jama'a Islamiyya. And the Jama'a Islamiyya has renounced violence 10 years ago, so it had now abandoned violence and now it decided to enter the political sphere as well. And the Jama'a Islamiyya's base was mainly in the Sa'id's, in middle and upper Egypt. But again, the strong element of the coalition is obviously Hezbollah, and they would provide for most of the means for the campaigning, and they have the biggest share, obviously, of the candidates on the list, and they would have the biggest number of candidates elected, by far above the other parties. The competition between the two coalitions, the Brotherhood's coalition and the Salafi coalition, was extremely fierce. But the Salafis were able to score a number of points. First, the Salafis denounced the Brothers, and this is what I saw again by doing fieldwork during the campaign. They denounced the Brothers as candidates of the old system, blaming them for being apparatchiks and opportunists who have happily participated in the facade democracy of the Mubarak years. In turn, the Salafis turned their quietism during the Mubarak years into an advantage. Because they had not been involved in politics during Mubarak, they argued, they had not been compromised. They were pure and clean. And so as opposed to the Brothers, they could introduce themselves as entirely new political actors, therefore presenting themselves as the most capable of representing real change. To reinforce this impression, Hezbollah strategically appointed spokesmen of a relatively young age, with no past in politics. And one of them, the 28-year-old Nader Bakar, an elegant young man with a degree in management, became one of the media faces of the party. He generated a tremendous media hype. He's basically invited on Egyptian talk shows every 2 days. Since he came on the scene late 2011, he became a media star. All the bosses had to offer in return were spokesmen in their 50s, who had been around in politics for decades, and could hardly represent any form of political renewal. So the Salafis really played that card very well. In addition, Hezbollah was quick to denounce the allegedly bourgeois nature of the Muslim Brotherhood and its leadership, describing it as disconnected from the Egyptian masses, from the Egyptian popular classes. Hezbollah portrayed itself in return as a true representative of the lowest class of society. This led the movement to adopt in its program leftist overtones, much more than the Muslim Brotherhood, for instance. The Salafis stressed social justice and advocated a redistributive role for the state, as opposed to the Brotherhood's charity-based model. One of the debates between the Salafis and the Brothers was about zakat. The Brothers advocated a society-based distribution of zakat, whereas the Brotherhood wanted zakat to go through the state and be redistributed to the state. So they were much more étatiste than the Brotherhood in that sense, and much more favorable to redistribution. This rhetoric was extremely effective. And this, in addition to the fact that the party was able to rely on the extensive networks of the Salafi Da'wah, explains, I think, the success of Hezbollah's campaign for the elections. And against all odds, Salafis received about 29% of the votes, and they had 24% of the seats in Majlis al-Sha'b, the parliament. This success would give Hezbollah increasing assertiveness, not only in Egyptian politics, but also vis-à-vis the Salafi Da'wah, whose political arm it was initially supposed to represent. From the beginning, as I said, Hezbollah had been an entirely new experiment for Salafis. Because the Salafi Da'wah had, for the last 30 years, systematically avoided political issues, Hezbollah had to elaborate its political discourse from scratch. And it did so in a rather surprising way, by forming a committee of academics, many of them non-Salafis, actually, people with Islamic tendencies, but not necessarily Salafis, from different faculties of Egyptian universities, economists, political scientists, etc. And these academics were in charge of writing the party's political platform. The Hezbollah leadership discussed the platform with them, obviously, to make sure that no religious red lines were crossed. But the result was a platform that was hardly distinguishable from the platform of any other political party, except maybe for a slightly stronger insistence on the Islamic reference, quote-unquote, Majayel Islami. At the same time, the party's platform advocated democracy and equal rights between Muslims and Christians, equal rights and duties between Muslims and Christians. To be accepted by the commission of parties, Hezbollah also had to include a certain percentage of Christians among its founding members, and so it did. And finally, to be allowed to participate in the elections, it had to include a woman on each of its lists. And again, Hizb al-Nur included a woman on each of its lists, although the party did not publish the pictures of those women. The pictures were sometimes replaced by a flower or by the logo of the party. And in one case, the woman candidate was referred to as the wife of and the name of her husband. But still, there was one on each list at the last position of the list, a position where she wouldn't get elected. But still, there was a woman on each of the lists. As minimal as this may sound, this represented a clear break from the positions of the Salafi Dawah. Dawah Sheikhs had in the past denounced democracy as kufr, and the main figure of the Salafi Dawah had actually written books to denounce the democratic system. And the Salafi Dawah Sheikhs had also insisted that Copts were not equal to Muslims. The involvement of women in the public sphere is also something that the Dawah had always rejected. Despite this, it seems that at the beginning, the Salafi Dawah accepted those concessions because they were convinced that they were the price to pay to enter the political sphere, but that they did not reflect a genuine commitment. Soon, however, conflicts between Hizb al-Nur and the Salafi Dawah started to take place. And I'm going to look at three issues here with you on which there was an open conflict between the two. The first was the question of political alliances. Party President Imam Abdel Rafour declared on numerous occasions that Hizb al-Nur would have no problem forging political alliances with non-Islamist parties, even leftist or liberal ones. He even said that he was ready to ally himself with Al-Mohsin al-Harab, Najib Sawid's liberal party. And as long this alliance, he said, was possible, as long as Salafis and other groups agreed on certain shared political goals. This owed him an extraordinarily virulent response by Sheikh Yasser Burhami from the Salafi Dawah the next day, arguing, and Sheikh Burhami argued, that an Islamic party can only ally itself with other Islamic parties that have the same marja'iyya islamiyya, the same Islamic reference. So here we see a conflict between two distinct logics, the political logic of Imam al-Dawafur and the religious logic advocated by the Sheikhs of the Salafi Dawah. A second clash happened when, in December 2011, Imam al-Dawafur was asked in a talk show why the Nur party had fielded no Christian candidates. He responded that he regretted the facts and that he hoped Christian would run on the party's lists at the next elections. This again earned explicit criticism from Sheikh Yasser Burhami on Sheikh Yasser Burhami's website, Fatwa was published, in which Burhami reaffirmed that only Muslims can occupy, I'm quoting, positions linked to the objectives of the Islamic State. He added that only Muslims can have wulay, only Muslims can have authority. No Christian should be allowed to have authority over Muslims, which would happen if Christians were elected in parliament. So, again, Imam al-Dawafur was trying to, as a politician, was trying to appeal to a constituency of Christian voters, and from a religious logic, Yasser Burhami told him this was not possible because this conflicted with the doctrine. A third clash happened when Mohammed Noor, who's one of the spokesmen of Hizb al-Nur, attended a celebration for the Iranian Revolution that was organized at the Iranian Diplomatic Bureau in Cairo. As a leading Egyptian political party, Mohammed Noor argues, it is normal for Hizb al-Nur to have relations with all states. But the Sheikhs of the Salafi Dawah didn't see it that way. And they were quick to denounce Mohammed Noor using the Salafi theological argument that Shiites are heretics, and so true Muslims can have no relation to them. The same kind of clash happened 2 weeks ago, again, some of you have been following the debates, when the president of the party, Imam al-Dawafur, attended a celebration for the creation of the Turkish Republic at the Turkish embassy in Cairo. And again, Burhami came out with a fatwa denouncing this by arguing that it is against Islam to celebrate the fall of the caliphate, which he understands to be the equivalent of the creation of the Turkish Republic. So again, we see here clearly the distinction between the political logic of the leadership of Hizb al-Nur and the religious logic advocated by the Salafi Dawah. So how can we make sense of this conflict? What this reflects, I argue, is that the creation of Hizb al-Nur has given birth to an autonomous dynamic of politicization. And with the foundation of Hizb al-Nur, a new social category emerged, the Salafi politician, that I call the Salafi politician, which increasingly identified itself with the political sphere and its rules, and developed what Pierre Bourdieu, again, would call a political habitus. As a consequence, Salafi sheikhs and Salafi politicians developed very different understandings of what they thought Hizb ul-Nur should be. What Salafi sheikhs were advocating from the start is what I call a pre-political vision, going back to the concept that I introduced at the beginning of the speech. What they wanted Hizb ul-Nur to be is merely a lobby to defend the interests of the Dawah in the political sphere. However, they were extremely wary of the political logic, and they didn't want Hizb ul-Nur to start practicing politics for the sake of politics. This understanding resembles what is found in Kuwait, where a political association called the Salafi Coalition, Tajammu' al-Salafi, has been, since 1981, the political arm of a religious movement, who's the main Salafi association of Kuwait, called the Association for the Revival of Islamic Heritage, Jami' Ihya al-Turas al-Islami. And when you look at the Salafi coalition in the last 30 years, you see that they have always been reluctant to offer a real political alternative. What they have mostly done during their 3 decades in parliament is to focus on certain specific social and religious issues that matter to them and to protect the interests of the Dawah, but they never came out with a full-fledged political program. Salafi politicians, in contrast, wanted Hizb ul-Nur to embrace the political logic fully. This to them meant that the movement had to revise some of its positions and that it should embrace some form of pragmatism. In contrast with the sheikhs, again, they saw that the Salafis had to develop a full-fledged political vision. From late 2011, conflicts started boiling between Salafi sheikhs and Salafi politicians. At the beginning, most of those conflicts were taking place behind closed doors. But what would trigger a real crisis is the Salafis' decision in April 2012 to back Abdelmunim Aboulfoutouh for the presidential elections that were scheduled to take place in May and June 2012. Aboulfoutouh, as I said, was an ex-Muslim Brotherhood leader who was known to be a liberal Islamist, who had disagreed with the Brotherhood because he thought they were too conservative on certain issues, and he had his candidacy for the presidency had previously received the support of leftists and liberals. And so given his background, the Salafi's decision was extremely surprising to many. The justifications provided by the Hizb ul-Nur leadership were strikingly political. And I'm quoting here from Yusuf Hamad, who's, so Hizb ul-Nur has three spokesmen, Yusuf Hamad, Abu Bakr, and Muhammad Nur. So this is the third spokesman. And this is how he justified Hizb ul-Nur's decision to back Aboulfoutouh. The party didn't request from Aboulfoutouh that he commit to implementing the rulings of the Sharia, and he didn't even offer that. We decided to support him because of his national project, which permits the consensus of all national forces to rebuild Egypt and get it out of the dark tunnel. After which he added, we are not electing a caliph or the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen. We're only electing a president. This line of argument wasn't obviously very popular with the Salafi Dawah, and a number of leading sheikhs of the Dawah even first publicly rejected the calls to support Aboulfoutouh, and they described him as Ayman, secular. The difference between this controversy and the previous ones, however, is that because Hizb ul-Nur had won 1/4 of the seats in the parliament, Hizb ul-Nur was now in a much stronger position vis-à-vis the Dawah. And Hizb ul-Nur's leadership was finally able to find allies in the Salafi Dawah to finally convince the Dawah to announce its support for Aboulfoutouh as well. In contrast with the political logic followed by Hizb ul-Nur's leadership, the Dawah's logic in supporting Aboulfoutouh again was what I call pre-political. As I heard in some of the Dawah meetings which I attended, the main argument offered by the sheikhs to explain the support for Aboulfoutouh was that they feared that a Muslim Brotherhood presidency would lead to a hegemony of the Brotherhood, not just in the political sphere, but also in the Islamic sphere, something that they saw as a clear threat to the interests of the Dawah. It was not so much that they wholeheartedly supported Aboulfoutouh, but they saw him as a lesser evil. And so, despite this, and despite those different understandings of why they supported Aboulfoutouh, both Hizb ul-Nur and the Salafi Dawah organized meetings in support of Aboulfoutouh, and they got involved in the campaign. And in spite of this, Aboulfoutouh only came fourth in the first round of the presidential election, so he didn't make it to the second round. The reason is that the Salafi base, it seems, was never able to understand the choice of the leadership to back Aboulfoutouh. And according to interviews I made, it seems that the majority of Salafis didn't vote for Abu Futuh. Some voted for Morsi, because, again, he was, to them, the more conservative candidate with which they mostly identified. Some invalidated their votes, and some stayed at home. This put the party in crisis and had three major consequences. The first was that the rivalry between the Dawah sheikhs and Hizb an-Nur politicians was revived. Or, in other terms, the rivalry between a pre-political conception and a political conception of Salafism. But this time, the Hizb an-Nur leadership was in a weaker position than ever. And this rivalry led to a full-blown crisis in Hizb an-Nur last September. The party's general elections had been scheduled to take place last September, so the party was supposed to elect a new high committee, a new president, and new local leaders for each government. But Imam al-Ghafur and the people around him accused the sheikhs of attempting to rig the elections in order to get individuals close to the Dawah elected to all positions. So they accused the sheikhs to try to manipulate the elections to get people close to them elected. The plan of the sheikhs, according to Abdel Ghafur, was to exclude the politicians and to regain complete control over the party. To prevent this, Abdel Ghafur decided to dismiss the party's high committee, some of whose members were described as agents of the Dawah, recording here. In return, the high committee of the party decided to dismiss Abdel Ghafur. So for a while, each side of the party dismissed the other. By late September, the party was in deep turmoil, and some people expected the party to collapse quickly. In the end, all sides agreed to return to the status quo in order to prepare for the upcoming legislative elections that are not scheduled yet, but that will take place once the constitution is written and accepted. So they decided to kind of freeze the conflict and postpone it to after the elections. But the debate remains there. The tensions remain extremely strong. I was speaking with some people in the party recently, and they were telling me how strong the tensions remain. And some argue that Hizb an-Nur could still disintegrate any moment. A second consequence of the crisis was that some Salafi sheikhs are now discovering that politics, by nature, have a corrupting effect on the doctrine. And they are ready to declare that the experiment of Salafi politics are a failure. And those sheikhs advocate a retreat from politics altogether and a return to the Dawah. But the current tensions are also benefiting another group, and this is the third consequence of the crisis. This group represents a third strain of Salafism that emerged in the second half of 2011. Those I call the populist revolutionary Salafis. So just like Imam al-Ghafur is the godfather of political Salafism, the main figure of populist revolutionary Salafism is a man called Hasan Salah Abu Ismail. Abu Ismail is a preacher and a lawyer who is the son of a prominent 1970s figure of the Muslim Brotherhood, but who embraced Salafi ideas. So he has a background with the Muslim Brotherhood, but he's completely out of it, and he is a Salafi. Though he's not very well known before the revolution, Abu Ismail has become a star in Egyptian politics since the summer 2011. While Salafi sheikhs remained in the mosques, and while Salafi politicians became formal political actors with the aim of entering the parliament, Abu Ismail acquired his legitimacy in the streets on Tahrir Square, a place in which Salafis had before that been mostly absent. And there, breaking with the more accommodationist leanings of Hizb an-Nur, Abu Ismail and his followers attended every demonstration they could to vocally express their opposition to military rule in Egypt, to the Supreme Council of Armed Forces. In parallel, Abu Ismail called for the establishment of a true Islamic state in the country and for the immediate implementation of Sharia, in other terms, for the advent of the Salafi utopia. While his radical opposition to the Supreme Council of Armed Forces earned him some respect among the broader revolutionary constituency, his political program attracted a growing number of Salafis, especially from the youth. And during the street battles of Muhammad Mahmoud in November 2011, I remember, I was in Cairo at the time, his appearance on the square every time in front of his followers were really incredible moments to witness. To them, he was nearly a messiah, a savior figure who had come to rescue Egypt from the hands of secularists and Fulun and, you know, people of the old regime. he embodied charisma in the purest sense. And going back to charisma, he was charismatic for sure. At the same time, Abu Ismail's discourse had some jihadi undertones. And there's nothing surprising here, since the language of revolution in Salafi Islam tends to coincide with the language of jihad. In a way, if you want to say revolution in, you know, in jihadi language, it's jihad. So again, you have some coincidence with the two constituencies, and eventually a growing number of jihadis, many who had been former members of the group at jihad, and had been released after the revolution, or some a bit before, also started sympathizing with Abu Ismail and started becoming followers of Abu Ismail. What complicated things is that Abu Ismail had also declared his candidacy to the presidency. The hype around him was so strong that by March 2012, he had at least 20% in most of the polls, and some even ranked him first. The possibility of him winning the election was taken seriously in Egypt and abroad. And this was a headache, not just for external and domestic actors, but also for the major Salafi groups, including the leaderships of the Salafi Dawah and Hizb al-Nur. The reason for that, first, the revolutionary rhetoric that Abu Ismail was advocating represented a complete departure from the traditional positions of the Salafi Dawah and Hizb al-Nur, and they rejected this. Second, they feared the rise to power of a proclaimed Salafi over which they had no control whatsoever. Abu Ismail is a free electron in the pure sense of the word. He doesn't belong to anything. They made it clear that they would not support him, but they knew he was deeply appealing to their bases, so that was a predicament for them. What was even more embarrassing is that tens of Hizb al-Nur's MPs, along with some of the major Salafi sheikhs, openly expressed support for Abdel Fattah's candidacy. Or Abu Ismail, sorry, his candidacy. Early April 2012, the relief came when the Electoral Commission in Egypt allegedly discovered that Abu Ismail's mother, who had spent some time in the United States, had acquired American citizenship. Which again is very ironical in Abu Ismail being the most anti-American candidate in the elections. This represented a violation of Egyptian electoral law, and Abu Ismail was disqualified. Although Abu Ismail denied the fact, and it is unclear until now whether this was true or not, and there are debates until now whether his mother was really American. Again, he has denied it. But now Abu Ismail was out of the race, and so the Salafi Dawah and Hizb al-Nur were relieved. Despite this, Abu Ismail's star has continued to shine, and many of his followers have created movements. One of them is known as Hazimun, the other one is Lazim Hazim. Both of them are friends of his name. Hazimun, so his name Hazim means the determined. So Hazimun means the determined ones, as much as it means the proponents of Hazim. And Lazim Hazim means we need Hazim, but there's a rhyme, right? And those Abu Ismail supporters have been active in street protests constantly since those groups came to be. They were, for instance, one of the major groups protesting in front of the American embassy when there was the controversy with the anti-Islam film, In the Sense of Muslims. They were also the main group protesting last Friday. There was a protest with the implementation of Sharia in Egypt, and opponents of Hazm were the main group on Tahrir Square. Hizb al-Nur and the Salafi Dawah were not present last Friday. It was mainly Hazm's followers. They are also, proponents of Hazm are also the main group to have been sending people to fight in Syria. So it seems that the biggest contingent of Egyptian fighters in Syria come from Abu Ismail's proponents in Egypt. Since the summer of 2012, Abu Ismail and his followers have been working to establish a political party representative of their populist revolutionary line. It is called Hizb al-Ummah al-Masriyah, the party of the Egyptian Ummah, and it is starting to establish its presence on the ground. Given the crisis the party is going through, Hizb al-Nur may lose a significant part of its membership to Hizb al-Ummah al-Masriyah. And the competition between Hizb al-Ummah al-Masriyah and Hizb al-Nur, I think, will be really worth watching during the upcoming legislative elections. They've already said they're not going to ally because they're on two different lines. So there are going to be probably two big Salafi groups competing next time in the elections. Again, the dates dates haven't been announced yet, but people expect them to be maybe early 2013 if things go well with the constitution. This contemporary populist revolutionary Salafism that I introduced here, I think, applies beyond Egypt. For instance, I think we could say that Tunisian Salafis mostly belong to that category. They're mostly populist revolutionary Salafis. And the case of the Tunisian group Ansar al-Sharia, which is the main Salafi group in Tunisia, it is what I would call a populist revolutionary Salafi group. And this shows the key difference between Egypt and Tunisia when it comes to Salafism in the wake of the Arab Spring. In Tunisia, most Salafis who lean towards a populist revolutionary approach have chosen street politics instead of institutional politics. In Egypt, it was a country. Most Salafis first chose institutional politics, despite the existence of a growing populist revolutionary fringe. So maybe we're coming back to something closer to Tunisia, but again, the choice at the beginning was completely different. I'll finish here with this question of how sustainable political Salafism is in Egypt. As we've seen, the Hizb al-Nur experiment is currently going through a deep crisis. The current leadership has lost the support of the sheikhs, and the party has become increasingly disconnected from the base of the movement. If Hizb al-Nur collapses, its place could be taken by Hizb al-Umar Masriya. But then what will happen if Hizb al-Umar Masriya's populist revolutionary line the populist revolutionary line of Hizb al-Umar Masriya if it abandons the streets and becomes part of the institutional setting it first rejected? So again, can you keep that line when you become part of the game, of the institutional game? And even if Hizb al-Nur's political Salafism manages to survive the crisis, one can wonder how sustainable a political option it could be on the long term. When Salafis become fully political and pragmatic, they resemble more and more the Muslim Brotherhood. And so their predicament is that they're aiming at the political space, which is already occupied. I leave you with these questions, and thank you.
Thank you. It was my fault. It nearly has at least an hour. So, you know, I'm sure you have many questions. So we'll take, let no commentaries and be as precise and specific as possible. Shall we? Please.
Yeah?
So shall we take, we'll take five questions every round, and then you like to...
Yeah, maybe a
please. You want to sit down here, or would you prefer to sit down here now? You want to stay with us? So we can.
I was wondering if you could comment on two things. It's a very interesting, very comprehensive presentation of the situation in Egypt and Salafism. I was wondering if you could comment on two things that you didn't mention or only alluded to slightly. One would be the influence and connections between the three strands of Egyptian Salafism you outlined and actors and entities outside of Egypt. I'm thinking particularly Saudi and the other GCC states. Secondly, I was wondering if you might be able to say something about the social base of the three strands of Salafism, both in terms of things like social class, generation, and the whole rural Madani division.
Thank you, Philippe. You have a question? No, please.
I have a question about the Kuwait movement now, the political crisis.
Speak a bit louder, please.
Yeah. Where does the Salafi school of thought in Kuwait stand on the political crisis in Kuwait? Is it with pro the activity in the streets?
Mm-hmm. John?
If we look at other cases of first post-authoritarian elections, whether it's in Europe, Latin America, Asia, we're now in the Middle East, it seems clear that the first election is an oddball, wild card election before the iron curtain of machine politics sets in. And this is all the more the case in Egypt with the NDP not able to contest with the restrictions and disincentives sort of allude to participate. With this in mind, beyond the religious field that you described so well, if we look at the larger political field, what about actual ways in which these very small numbers of activists could mobilize millions of voters in a country of 80 million people? In practice, how do they actually mobilize people in terms of the kinds of partnerships, the kinds of funding sources, and other linkages in terms of voter mobilization that actually drew people to vote for them on the ground? And what would we see from that in terms of further evidence in support of your thesis that we should expect fragmentation and disappointment for these people in the political field
to come around. Thank you.
Cameron? Thanks for the great lecture. I want to return to your original field, Saudi Arabia. So the expectation was that, you know, if the project of political parties, Salafist political parties, takes off in Egypt, there should be some sort of a feedback into Saudi Arabia. And so the question is, where, in the light of this fragmentation of political Salafists in Egypt and Tunisia, what kind of impact are we looking at in Saudi Arabia?
One last question in the first round, please.
I have actually two questions. The first one is the funding. Where do they get their money from, literally? Because you hear about the, you know, the Qatari and Saudi Arabian bomb. And the second, how do they deal with the scandals affecting the members? I mean, we've heard about the, you know, the nose job and the agricultural road with a woman.
Well, take it easy on nose job, really.
And all those, you know, scandals that it's not only one, like calling to dismantle the pyramids and all these scandals. How do they deal with this?
She's. Thank you. So, shall we?
Yes. Okay, a lot of great questions. Thank you. Okay, so let's talk about the external factor. I think some of the questions were about, especially Saudi Arabia, right? Saudi Arabia's role in all this. I don't see. I mean, there's this whole idea that this is a geopolitical game between Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia supports the Salafis, Qatar supports the Brotherhood, and they're playing by proxy against each other. I don't really subscribe to that thesis. I think that when you look at the Egyptian Salafi movement, there is indeed money coming from Saudi Arabia, but I think it's coming mainly through private networks. I don't think that the Saudi state. Policy is to openly support Egyptian Salafis. For one of the reasons that you mentioned is that, again, if Egyptian Salafis succeed in politics, then they could actually represent a model that would be detrimental to the royal family in Saudi Arabia. So they have no interest in supporting Salafis. Why should they? And I think the Saudis have understood for a long time that Salafism doesn't necessarily mean being pro-Saudi. That is, they've experienced themselves in the 90s in Saudi Arabia a lot of anti-royal family Salafi activism. So they've understood for quite some time that, again, this idea that, you know, someone who's a Salafi will necessarily support their interest it just doesn't work. So if Saudi Arabia supports someone in Egypt, at least supported someone before Morsi's election, he was probably more the scab than anything else. I think the Saudi Arabia was actually feeling much better with the military and was before that feeling much better than with Mubarak, right? We should not have an over-ideological reading of Saudi regional politics, right? They, in the 1994, they supported the communist secessionists in Yemen because they thought that this was good for their interests. In the 60s, they supported the Zaidi movement in Yemen as well because it supported their interests. So, again, we cannot look at Saudi regional policies through the only prism of ideology. And in that case, I think this is not a state policy to support Salafis. Again, then there's a lot of money coming from Saudi Arabia. It's coming through private networks, it's coming through sheikhs, it's coming through merchants in Saudi who have a lot of money and who give money for da'wah purposes. It certainly goes with, not necessarily the blessing of the state, but the state doesn't really interfere, that's probably true. Also because of, you know, internal balances within Saudi Arabia. That is, probably some sheikhs in Saudi Arabia have, you know, sufficient aura within the system that the Saudi state doesn't want to be seen as preventing them from doing da'wah. So because this would be a scandal in Saudi Arabia, and this would delegitimize the Saudi regime. So it's probably more internal considerations that lead the Saudis to let some people fund Salafi movements outside than a real strategic calculation of let's use the Salafis. That's my take on this. But then what is happening today, talking about the regional politics, which is quite interesting, is that Egyptian Salafis are providing a model for other Salafis around. Some of you who work on Palestine may have seen that 2 months, or I think a month and a half ago, Hizb an-Nur was created in Gaza that take inspiration from the Egyptian Hizb an-Nur and wants to compete with Hamas in Gaza. So now, actually, the Salafi Dawah is expanding its own connections to other countries. Yasser Burhami is, I think, today, he's traveling. He was in Qatar recently, and now he's traveling and he's preaching, I think in the Sudan. So they also, but the Sudan also has a Salafi movement for a while. But the Salafi sheikhs have been starting to travel, and to try, and the people from the Dawah have been trying to travel, and it seems to try to establish branches of the Dawah in different places. So what some people have argued, I just read a paper today by a great young Egyptian scholar called Ahmed Zaghloul, who was wondering whether they're trying, because we've seen that from the beginning, Salafi Dawah was kind of fascinated by the model of the Muslim Brotherhood. In a way, they modeled the Dawah after the Muslim Brotherhood from the beginning. So now they're trying to create a Tanzim Dawah. They're trying to create an international organization mirroring the one that the Brotherhood had. So, so again, it goes both ways. It's not just from Saudi to Egypt, it's also from Egypt to other places. Regarding the social base of the different strains, that's a very good question. I would say that Abu Ismail has a lot of young people. Abu Ismail works very well with the young. And if you see the protest organized by Abu Ismail followers, you have an over-representation of young people. I think Hezbollah Noor has people from all ages, so it's not really a generational thing. But certainly, from when it comes to the base of support, it certainly comes from lower-class neighborhoods. So their attempt to play this rhetoric of supporting the poor actually works somehow. It doesn't translate in the structure of the Dawah or Hezbollah Noor, because if you look at the people representing the party, they're all engineers, well-established, some of them quite wealthy. So it's not the people running the party or the Dawah. But if you look at the electoral base in particular, there seems to be more Salafi votes in more in poorer neighborhoods. So this is where you could see something that has to do with the social base. The Brotherhood having more support in middle-class neighborhoods. So this seems to work on the ground, although it would need more studies. I mean, this is a bit half-baked at this stage. We don't have that many studies to prove that. But what I know in Alexandria from the different neighborhoods that I've been looking at is that the poor neighborhoods voted Salafi very strongly. And the middle-class neighborhoods voted more for the Brothers. Or for Sabahi, actually, but that's another issue. But you can see this divide. When it comes to Kuwait, the Salafis in Kuwait, there was a split in the 90s. So Tajammu' Salafi, in a way, the debate between the pre-political and political Salafis already took place in Kuwait in the 90s. There was a split with a movement called Al-Haraka Salafiyya, which was the Salafi movement, which advocated a kind of more proactive political stance. And then out of the Haraka Salafiyya, later on emerged Hizb al-Ummah, which is a kind of pro-democratic Salafi party, which represents one small part of the Haraka Salafiyya, with people like Hakim al-Mutairi. The political Salafis are the ones you see now supporting the protest in Kuwait. Walid Tabtaba'i, for instance, who was arrested last week, is one of the figures of the political Salafis who were in Haraka Salafiyya in the 90s and split with the mainstream Salafi because they disagreed with the pre-political conceptions, I think. So here again, the traditional Salafis would generally be, not willing to oppose the regime as clearly and to stay kind of in the back in the retreat, whereas the political Salafis are much more active in the protest these days. So you see the same divide.
But the scholars and scholars in Kuwait, they support which?
The scholars, I mean, you don't have that many big Salafi scholars in Kuwait, apart from Dahman al-Khaliq. And I haven't seen if he's taken a stance. I wonder, actually, I'm not following Kuwait that closely, so I don't know. It would be interesting to see if Abdurrahman al-Khaliq has taken a stance. But I would be surprised if he supported the protest. But I can be wrong, but I don't think he has. Again, I would need to check that. When it comes to how John's question about how they got their votes and how it worked on the ground, one of the things that there was, of course, the rhetoric, and it worked with some people. There was the networks of the Salafi Dawah, and networks of the Salafi Dawah are quite a big thing. The Muslim Brotherhood claims probably 2 million people across Egypt. My guess would be that the Salafi Dawah can claim 100,000, which is quite, which is significant to mobilize people, right? And in different places in Egypt. So they have an organized structure with, again, a group of people that's not as big as the Brotherhood, but it still has a mobilizing power in itself. But what they also did is that they co-opted a lot of local notables during the elections. It was, you know, if you were a local notable in some village in Fayoum and you want to present yourself to the elections, you're somehow Islamic, you have a beard, you're conservative, and you're looking for a label to run with. The Brotherhood won't give it to you because the Brotherhood have their people enlist waiting to be candidates. So the Brotherhood would never appoint as candidate someone from outside. To be a candidate of the Brotherhood, you have to be in the movement for a long time and you know, you have to go through different ranks. Because the Salafis were completely new, they were able to take people from, you know, out of nowhere and turn them into candidates. And in that case, what they did is that they took a lot of those local notables who had some, again, social influence, who were, you know, well-known at the social level, and who now could run with the Salafi label and use it to get elected and bring a vote to the Salafis. So in many cases, they relied on those strategies of aligning themselves with local notables. They did. And it's probably one of the reasons why later on in the parliament they have such an incoherent parliamentary group. Because a lot of people actually are not really Salafis in the parliament. So many of them are local notables who ran with a Salafi label, who identify somehow with Salafism, but are not necessarily hardcore Salafis. I mean, I recall doing an interview with a Salafi candidate in Cairo, whose name I'm not going to give you to, because for his own sake, but who lost in the second round against a Muslim Brotherhood candidate, and who, when I met him, explained to me that 6 months ago he didn't have a bet, so now he had one, so he showed me the pictures, and he said, yeah, of course, I like to drink wine, and I go to France, and when I come next time, I visit you, and we can have some wine together, and I was very surprised, and at the same time, he said, I like the Salafis, I admire them, I wish I was like them, I cannot be like them. No, it was really interesting, this course. He's like, they're great people. I think they're the people for the most. I mean, they should rule Egypt because they are pure. And so he would reproduce that rhetoric of purity. But it's not. I'm not really like that. But again, I run for them. And the story goes that, I mean, this is what he told me, that the Brotherhood discovered this, that he liked wine, and they campaigned against him on the second round based on this, and that's why he lost. So he said, I found myself at the second round between the rock of the liberals calling me an extremist and the hard place of the Brotherhood calling me a liberal and a wine drinker, and so I lost everyone and I didn't make it. But again, I mean, this man could have been in parliament, so I don't know Anwar al-Balkini, for instance, the guy with the nose job. I mean, I don't want to talk about him in person. But he may be one of those who's not really one of those very committed Salafis. I mean, I have no information about him personally, but he may belong to these kind of, you know, local notables who were co-opted and who... So that's why you have such a heterogeneous group in parliament. And this has been a headache for the Salafis, because they've brought in people who have very little party discipline, who come up with proposals that are not accepted by the leadership. This is why also, you know, they've created so many scandals in parliament, because again, the party has had a hard time keeping the constituency together. I think I responded to pretty much everything. Can just on the pyramid thing, it was not a Salafi Dawah guy, it was a jihadi guy who came with, recently, it was Magan Salem, who was a former member of the Jihad, who is the one who said that the pyramids and the Sphinx should be destroyed. But he was not a Salafi Dawah member, he was a jihadi, so.
Please.
Just a couple of points in regards to, apology you mentioned at the beginning. Sometimes it could be slightly problematic in that people get confused, and that it comes across that there are many different types of Salafis and representatives of Dawah Salafi and so forth. And it's a kind of problem that we also experience in the UK, and that of late people will, I've worked with a Salafi mosque in London. So what happened is that we contacted, what do you think about Abu Qatada, Abu Hamza, etc. And they have this impression that they also represent Dawah Salafi, so sometimes with regards to typology, you want to discuss with me about that and how to sort of label some of these other trends. And some scholars as well have noted that sometimes it's best to describe these trends being qutbi, for example, in that they represent more sort of the methodology. That goes on to the second point, which is that in Egypt itself, Hizbullah is Salafi, and kind of with Salafi Iskandaria. It's been strongly criticized of late, but by many.
Well, what's your question? Do you have a question? So, because we really were running out of time, and apologies.
So, just wanted to mention that what do you feel with regards to that discussion, which is also raising criticism of that they're not actually representative of Salafi at all?
It's a good question, yeah.
Please.
Yeah, so very similar question, actually, when I hear of all these differences between actors, group, political or non-political, all calling themselves Salafi, or using a Salafi label, as you just said. What is the value of the category Salafism, and what does Salafism mean? And then second of all, is there some kind of cooperation between different political, newly emerged political Salafi parties throughout the Middle East?
Thank you. Please.
I know you said that in the end their platform wasn't very different from most other parties. How comprehensive was the Salafi or is the Salafi approach to politics? For example, do they try to offer any kind of alternative to the economic system, or do they say left?
Thank you. Please. Yes.
The way I look at it is that the common...
You please speak a bit louder because it's a huge room. Sorry, we don't have a microphone.
Well, actually, the common factor between the Salafists, the Muslim Brothers, and the Al-Qaeda is jihad, used in different ways. Do you think there is any connection between Zawahiri's statement last week about another revolution to implement Sharia Islamiyah and their demonstration coming up? And do you think there is any kind of presence, and particularly it has been confirmed by the Minister of Interior, that Zawahiri is popular in Egypt and he means Egypt's best interest. So is there any connection or is there a presence for Al-Qaeda at this moment?
Thanks. Please.
I want to know if there are any official numbers on pronounced Salafis in Egypt and if you can make a sense if there's a big difference between the 29% of Salafis and the actual people in
You said 49%?
No, 29.
29, yes. Please.
Yes, what is the platform with regard to raising the employment level, if any? Do they have a platform on it?
20 minutes. Shall we take another round? So when it takes...
Oh, you want to ask?
Yeah, okay. So when it takes 7 minutes.
So I'll try to...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for the great questions. So your question is indeed a good one. That is, there is... a faction that refuses politics altogether and that still exists in Egypt. Today, they're very much a minority in the Egyptian case. And certainly because some of them in the revolution context have kind of been discredited in Egypt because people saw them as, having been part of the old regime. You have names like Oussam al-Qawsi. You have names like even Mohammed Said Ghassan, who are seen today, who've lost a lot of their constituency, I think, because of the revolutionary moment. And, a lot of people moved away from them towards the more politicized group. So there is still in Egypt the critique of politics at all. People who say, and the crisis in Hizb-ut-Nur probably giving them a little bit of momentum today. They say, people are saying, we told you. One of them, Ahmed al-Naqib, if you're following, has one a video recently in which it's called We Told You. That is, we told you so. Commenting on Hizb-ut-Nur's crisis and saying, we told you from the beginning that if you start doing this, this is how it's going to end. So this movement exists. It's probably gaining a bit of strength today. I think it's still not very big in Egypt. In other countries, it's much bigger. I was in Jordan last month. In Jordan, it's the majority. The majority of Salafis don't want to have anything to do with politics. And the ones who advocate entering politics are a tiny minority. But again, this, if Jordan has a revolution, will they change? Will they go the same way as Hizb-ut-Nur? Again, those are a lot of debates within the Salafi movement. So, but in the case of Egypt, I think those have really become a minority for the moment. When it comes to the word Salafism, if you look at what Salafism is at the beginning, there really is an insistence on certain things that you find with Salafis. This idea of the purity of the creed, al-aqidah. There's this idea that Sufis, for instance, are out of Islam, or you know, or they're just on, you know, depending on who you're talking to, some would put them out of Islam, some would say they're very bad Muslims. But there is a rejection of Sufism, for instance, that all Salafis would share. There is a strong anti-Shiite sentiment, right? Because all of this is seen as, I mean, Shiism or Sufism are seen as violations of Tawhid, right? Because Sufis and Shiites are seen as worshipping other people than God, associates, intermediaries. So this is something the Salafis, all Salafis would agree. They wouldn't like Sufis. I mean, someone who defends Sufis can call himself a Salafi. And also there's the second idea of, imitating the Prophet and his companions in everyday life, you know, and that's the second element. Of course, today, when it came to politics, Salafis took many different routes. So the main thing that has been distinguishing them today is their attitude towards politics. But when it comes to what they call al-manhaj, they would all agree on this rejection of, you know, of what they see as heterodox Islam, and on the necessity to follow prophetic practices and companions' practices in everyday life. This is where you'd find the core. But again, when you talk about politics, you'd find them from the extreme left to the extreme right. Regarding the economic system, it's very broad. What I said is that you do have, certainly, but it may also be because, again, they are closer to the lower classes of society, so they have a stronger insistence on social justice. They have, this idea of a kind of more redistributive system that they have put forward in their program, that they want a state that redistributes wealth, which the Brotherhood doesn't advocate. So this is where you'd see a difference. When it comes to riba, the Brotherhood and them would agree that interest rates are forbidden. Although there was a debate recently on whether the IMF loan was acceptable or not, and actually some Salafi Shias came up saying that it was acceptable. So it's interesting that, again, it's part of this kind of drive towards more pragmatic attitudes. And the argument was that because it's a 2% interest rate, it can be considered masarif idariya. It can be considered administrative fees. So it doesn't qualify as interest rate. So some actually came up with arguments to accept the IMF loan, for instance. Again, others disagreed. There was a debate, but still some of them said... So, you know... But apart from that, it's not very clear. And I don't even think the Brotherhood has a very clear economic platform either. So, and I don't think anyone in Egypt today, and when you look at different political parties, no one seems to have a very clear political platform, though. So it's not something the Salafis have only. When it comes to the jihadis, I mentioned the jihadis who support Abu Ismail, and there's been quite a bit of them. There is a jihadi movement in the Sinai, of course, I didn't mention that, who is more in a kind of, you know, anti-Israel, more internationalist strategy that is much closer to the Al-Qaeda strategy. But those are localized in the Sinai. They are focusing on Israel at the moment. But, you know, what people are saying is that eventually, because the state is going to prevent them from attacking Israel, they will turn against the state. So this attitude of attacking Israel, I mean, it reminds me of the jihadis in Saudi Arabia when they started the campaign in 2003, 2004. At the beginning, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula said, we're not targeting the state, we're targeting the Americans. But then they said, if the state stands behind us and the Americans, we'll target the state. And they ended up targeting the state. So the jihadis in the Sinai for the moment have an anti-Israeli agenda, but it could turn into an anti-state agenda. Then in Cairo, you have also groups of jihadis. And interestingly, they're led by the brother of Ayman al-Zawahiri, Muhammad al-Zawahiri, who was freed from Egyptian jails last year, and who's become a local jihadi leader in Cairo. But he doesn't advocate violence at the moment, right? And when you hear him speak, you know, there's a lot to justify violence. But what they're saying is, for the moment, you know, we're not moving. And for the moment, you know, some of them you would find in the same demonstrations as the populist revolutionary Salafis. But again, they certainly constitute a separate group, they certainly have their own history, and they certainly could, you know, go another way. I mean, again, all of this remains to be seen. I think I responded to pretty much everything. No, about the Salafis and the numbers. I would say, certainly 29% of Egyptians are not Salafis. I generally describe, you know, you have different categories. You have the Salafis in the stricto sensu, that is, people who are effectively in Salafi networks, who have the whole Salafi appearance, who attend lessons of Salafi sheikhs, you know. If you take these people, you'd be in the hundreds of thousands, probably not more. Then you have a whole trend of people I would call mutasallifun, you know, people who are... Salafi leaning, right? They're not necessarily part of any network. But, you know, Salafi discourse has become very strong in Egypt today. You know, I myself, for instance, I did this little poll, homemade poll. I was asking taxi drivers for 2 weeks, every time I saw a woman with niqab in the street, what they thought. Like, oh, there's a woman with niqab. It's, you know, there's been a lot of women with niqab these days in Egypt, just to see what you would say. More than half of the taxi drivers told me niqab is the correct Islamic dress. Interestingly, a lot of them said, my wife doesn't wear niqab, but she should, or inshallah she will. But it's interesting that you see that those, you know, the Salafi ideas have gained a lot of ground. So they're not seen as something alien to a lot of people. So certainly you had a whole phenomenon of people who would subscribe to those ideas, who would do some form of a la carte Salafism. They would take a bit of this, wish to Sheikh Mohammed Hassan, and then they would watch another channel. You know, so it's difficult to put people in boxes. And certainly, and among the 29% who voted, there's people who are not Salafi at all, who just voted for other reasons, because they subscribe to this idea that, you know, they were not compromised under Mubarak, they are pure, they are new, that's what Egypt needs, they're Islamic, so they're good people, you know, and that was it. So, again, one should not read too much into the 29% when it comes to the...
So this really begs the question, what explains the rise and expansion of the Salafist movement, the Salafist ideas? Because one of the accepted... received wisdom is that, in fact, centrists, Islamists are becoming more centrist, more modern. In fact, young brothers and young Islamists tend to be much more open-minded, much more forthcoming. Yet what you're really saying is that there's also a kind of the rise of the Salafist movement, Salafist ideas are fertilizing the Egyptian soil. What really is it? Is it the Saudi influence? Is it basically the social economic conditions in Egypt? How do you explain this particular phenomenon?
I think it's a mix of all. As I said, the Salafi discourse has become very mainstream in Egypt. It's not seen by many people as alien or... I mean, if you ask Egyptians in the street to name three sheikhs, they certainly would come up with two Salafi sheikhs at least, maybe three. I mean, Mohammed Hassan, everyone would name him first. And it's even if you look at sheikhs only, it's very difficult to name a famous sheikh in Egypt who's not a Salafi. Then, you know, you would have Al-Khalid maybe, but people wouldn't maybe consider him a sheikh. But if you take people who are considered sheikhs by people, most of them would be Salafis. This means that the ideas are seen by many as, you know, ideas that in themselves have become pretty mainstream.
Why? That's the question. I mean, what has happened in the last, you know, 10 years or so?
I think it has to do with Salafi TV channels played a big role. That's the Islamic discourse.
Coming back to the state, the role of the state.
The Mubarak state.
Same way, but I mean, this is really a critical point to highlight.
It's not just about the Saudis.
It's what the strategic decision on the part of the state to counterbalance its main enemies. And as a result, now you have a critical. And the question then, what will happen? The state is no longer there. What will happen next elections?
The rhetoric that the Salafis used in at least the legislative elections doesn't work that much anymore, right? You can be pure and new the first time. You cannot be pure and new the second time. That is, this is a one shot.
We'll come back to John's question, which is really very critical. I wonder how much weight shall we invest in the whole idea of the first elections, the first round?
No, I agree.
What will happen? I mean, this is a social phenomenon unfolding before our eyes. And as you said, we're seeing more fragmentation, more disintegration. Let's see what's going to happen in the next one or the second or the third rounds.
I was meeting last month with one of the spokesmen of the Salafi movement in Egypt, who himself said, we're going to get 10% next time.
That's more
that's less. And he said it himself.
And that's five more questions. So
yes.
We'll take 2-3 minutes and then we'll give you... please.
How strong do you think the Salafist movement in Syria, if there's a movement there, or it will be?
Thank you. Please.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell us your view on the army's
louder,
role
please.
In politics?
Louder.
Could you tell us the role of the army's role in politics in terms of the Egyptian revolution versus the revolution in Bahrain?
Thanks.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Any of the contingent here? Any of the al-Ukhwa? No question? please.
From your last sentences before the question came in, talking to the taxi drivers, I had the impression that they voted Salafist without knowing what Salafist meant, what fundamentally Salafist meant. And what is the situation in Morocco in relation to Jordan? Because you mentioned that Jordan, they were not in politics. Would it be the same in Morocco?
Please.
Over the previous weekend, there were clashes in Saida in South Lebanon between Salafist Sheikh and Hezbollah. Do you have any predictions or any information about the movement in Lebanon itself?
That's a big phenomenon, by the way. Please.
I'm just wondering any differentiation of the three Salafist trends regarding accommodation with Israel made into the peace treaty?
Mm-hmm. Any question, please? Yes.
We'll rest.
As this evening has gone on, it seems to me that more and more it's been. There's a question about whether it's really about religion at all. As far as party leaders are concerned, it's how to acquire and maintain a constituency. And amongst the masses, it's about identity and developing polarities in when you don't have existing political structures. And a lot of what has been said about Salafism, which is a Sunni movement, could equally be said about the Sabrists in Iraq or about the Houthis in Yemen. And it seems to me that it's more about politics than it is about religion.
7 minutes.
Okay, I'll try to do that. There are some questions on which I don't think I can really respond with authority. In Syria, for instance, I know it's a very debated topic. Following Egypt takes all of my day.
By the way, we have a speaker on the 25th of November who just came from Syria and spent 8 months. His name is Nir Rosen, who's a specialist on the Islamists in Syria. So please join us on the 25th of November. Same move.
Neil Rosen would answer that question much better than I would. I mean, I would recommend the ICG report that came out a week ago, which seems to have a balanced take on the issue, but argues that there is a rise in Salafism, but certainly not as big as some people say. So, I would be safe and stick with ICG. But I don't really think I can really be useful on this. You know, you have some figures that have given the impression that it's bigger, like Adnan Arour, who's this Syrian sheikh who was in Saudi and who's speaking on television channels with a very kind of, you know, also very sectarian discourse sometimes. But certainly his media presence is quite disconnected from what really happens on the ground, I think. So that's what I would say.
Shall we?
Yeah. Yes. And then there's Lebanon. Same thing. I'm not sure I can speak with authority on Salafis in Lebanon that much. Again, I would need 48 hours a day to follow. Egypt is, you know, enough for me at the moment. I keep an eye on Saudi, but really don't think I can. But maybe Fawaz actually has.
Please.
when it comes to to Morocco, there seems to be a drive towards politics in Morocco. There was a very interesting piece recently about this group who's trying to establish a Salafi political party in Morocco around a guy who's called Abu Hafs, who was recently released from jail and who was one of the sheikhs imprisoned after the Casablanca bombings, and who came out as a, you know, much more, you know, politically aware, you know, anti-violence Salafi when he came out of jail, and now he's advocating, you know, playing institutional politics and creating a party, and he seems to be someone who's pretty well known in Morocco, so he may succeed. The party isn't created at the moment. I don't know how the monarchy is going to react. That's another big question, of course. But in Morocco, there seems to be this attempt is there, and I think it shows something about how. This experience of Salafis in politics has been giving inspiration to Salafis elsewhere. And in a country like Morocco, I think it's a place where it could happen. I met some people in Jordan, but they're a very tiny group who want to establish a party, but they really represent a few percent, I think, of Salafis in Jordan. The majority are against politics still. When it comes to Israel, it's an interesting issue. The Hezbollah Nor has had a very moderate, quote-unquote, position on Israel. They have not been more radical than the Brotherhood. And actually, they even ended up, at one point, getting in in a controversy because Yusuf Hamad, one of the spokesmen, in I think December 2011, gave this interview to the Israeli military radio, in which he said that Salafis don't have anything against the peace treaty with Israel. If they come, if they're in power, they will respect it, and that Israeli tourists are welcome in Egypt, which you know created actually controversy with the Brotherhood accusing him of being too lenient in Israel. So then he said he didn't know it was the Israeli military radio to defend himself, that he was tricked into giving the interview. But still, he said it, right? So you know, regardless of where he gave the interview, he actually said it. And Hezbollah Nur generally has not been taking very radical positions. Hazem Salah Abu Ismail is very radical. And the populist revolutionary Salafis have a much more radical stance on Israel. Hazem is probably the only, in the election, when he was a candidate, he was the only candidate advocating, putting a unilateral end to the peace David agreement, to the Camp David agreement. So he was one of the, he was the most hardcore in Israel. He even launched at some point his campaign late, I think it was early 2012. He had calculated the amount of American aid to Egypt based on the Camp David agreement. So he had said that it was, if you take $2 billion and divide it by Egyptians, it was like £72 per Egyptian. So he launched this campaign called Regain Your Dignity for £72, which was a campaign so that his group raises the money that comes from the United States and they can abolish the treaty with Israel. So he was certainly the one who went the furthest. But Hezbollah Nur, you know, they haven't been very vocal on that issue. And yes, I would also completely agree with the idea that this is not just about Salafism. This is about religion and politics. And you could find very similar debates when a religious movement moves into politics, and the movement has to accommodate between the doctrine and, you know, and trying to keep the doctrine as pure as possible and the necessary compromises that politics brings in. So I agree that this can be brought into a bigger argument than just Salafism, for sure. And the army's role in politics. This is a big question. I'll answer very briefly. I'm not sure the army is out of politics today in Egypt, as it was claimed. I think that the Brotherhood have made a deal, but they have been clever enough to make a deal with another faction in the military against the faction that was dominant at the time of the SCAF. So they've played one faction against another. That for the moment, Abdel Fattah Sisi and the people who have replaced Tantawi are playing the game. But you know, they represent an institution that has a strong corporatist feeling, that has, you know, that you know, thinks as an institution and not just as individuals at the head of the institution. So should he try to curb its prerogatives, should they try to curb its privileges, there is certainly going to be another episode of tension with the army. And you can see that the Brotherhood are well aware of that, because in the Constitution, the draft that we've seen, they've actually kept a lot of the role of the army in the draft that we've seen. So they've not been trying to take the army out of politics, right? And the SCAF still plays a role, and the Minister of Defense still has to be someone from the SCAF, and etc. So I wouldn't, you know, the whole thing late August that, oh, it's finished, the army's out of politics in Egypt, I wouldn't bet on that. We'll have to see where it goes.
Perfect timing. Thank you for a highly rich interview.